hunger strike at the White House, women in the streets of Zambia, crashing the school of the Americas, observers banned from Mexico, vaginal birth after cesarean, and farewell to a musical healer. Stay tuned to Wings News.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
The Women's Peace Vigil and Fast at the White House is a grassroots campaign by women from all over the country to prevent the war in Iraq and refocus national priorities towards schools, healthcare, and housing for the world's poor. The vigil will last for 4 months, with different women's groups committing to 4-day stints of sitting outside the White House to bring attention to the issue. It began on November 17th and will culminate in a Women's Peace March on International Women's Day, March 8, 2003, which will begin in front of the White House in Washington, D.C. Diane Wilson is one of the women who started the vigil, which 30 women's and peace groups, including the National Organization of Women, Interfaith Women for Peace, and the Feminist Majority, endorsed.
It was an idea that sprung up probably around about 6 women, because there didn't seem to be anything really going on about the war. I mean, there's been some pretty big marches, but, you know, even in the papers, those don't get printed like they really are. You know, they might say they're tens of thousands when they were 100,000. And I think women have a real special voice against war and violence. So we just decided as women we were going to do something. And in Texas, I've did a hunger strike because fighting the chemical plants and trying to get them to recycle their wastewater. So I said, you know, why can't we do a vigil, a fast?
Diane Wilson has committed to a 40-day fast during which she will drink only water. She began the fast on November 17th.
In India, there's a long tradition of fast and hunger strikes. As a matter of fact, we've also had quite a few civil rights, you know, Cesar Chavez, Martin Luther King, and Gandhi called it a soul power. And I think it's an internal thing, and you're putting out your intent. And matter of fact, a lot of women have been attracted. As a matter of fact, we find women down at the park all the time wanting to come and sit down on the vigil. I've had women that want to be a part of the fast. They want to try to do a fast. And I just think it's something they can do, and it's a commitment from inside. And I truly believe our soulful commitments can change the world.
Other women are also committing to shorter fasts, including Nina Utney of Utney Magazine.
I'm not prepared to take on the commitment that Diane has, which is a 40-day water fast. I've committed to a 7-day liquid fast, you know, so I'm taking a little bit of lemon juice and honey or a little bit of broth. That's what I feel like I can manage. But as Diane says, it's really about deepening our sense of intention and community. And actually, that's been one of the things that's been really strong for me, is knowing that I'm doing this in a community of other people who are also consciously trying to deepen their commitment and their consciousness. So I think this is really an invitation to people to just go inside themselves and really connect with what they care about and what incremental steps they're prepared to make to try to build some energy towards really changing the direction we're going.
The women hope that their commitment to stay outside in front of the White House during these cold winter months will help wake people up to the real costs of war, the human costs, and the fact that this war is completely unnecessary and is being pushed forward by the Bush administration not to stop terrorism, which it won't, but to control the oil in the Middle East.
I truly believe the thing that is driving this war is oil. I think it's driving our energy policy. It pollutes our bays, you know, and I live in a town where none of the fishermen have health insurance, you know, and I have to bus my son, who's autistic. I have to bus him 20 miles a day just to go to school. And here they're wanting to spend $200 billion to go to, maybe 6 months of a war. And I just believe this is an unjust war. I think it's an oil grab. And we have suffered too much from this oil agenda, and for us to be invading a country for oil, I think it's real wrong.
There's a statistic I heard from the Rocky Mountain Institute recently that just I found so shocking, that if every car on the road, and we're not talking trucks or, you know, we're just talking cars, if every car got only 2.7 miles per gallon more, we would have no use for Middle Eastern oil. And I just think our priorities are completely screwy and nobody's really talking about it.
The Women's Peace Vigil is not exclusive to women.
This is being initiated by women. But it's by no means exclusively. I think it's more about, not just about women, but really about the feminine, about let's really elevate the values of compassion and caring and nurturing and honoring the earth. You know, that's for men, too. Yeah.
To find out more information or to offer support, go to www.unitedforpeace.org or call 202-393-5016. For information on the Women's Peace Vigil. From the Independent Media Center in Washington, D.C., this is Jenka reporting for Wings.
The women's movement in Zambia took to the streets of Lusaka July 15th, along with many other members of the public, to protest the plunder of the economy by former Zambian President Frederick Chiluba. Susan Musukuma of Wings was there.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I want to find out, what are you doing here?
We are trying to send, we are sending a message to the government and to those that have squandered the Zambian resources, which has resulted, as you know, to our children not going to school, our people having less than one meal per day. Some cannot even afford a meal per day. Our people are on the streets, they are not employed because of, you know, the fake privatization that was being carried out, the sale of our mines at giveaway prices, and many other scandals which all culminate in the loss of, you know, millions of dollars which should have gone to promoting the quality of life of Zambians. As a women's movement, together with other civil society organizations, we have been consistent in putting across the message that something had gone very wrong in the management of our country as well as the resources by the last government. But all along, of course, as you may know, there were people who were cynical and, you know, calling us all sorts of names. But we are happy to say that we have been vindicated today, because from what you saw yesterday, the things that were brought out, you know, swindling this country and these people of its needed resources, which has in the end sent a lot of people to their early deaths from frustrations, from poverty, from lack of access to drugs and medical care. Because just about everything in the economy, you know, collapsed. And as you know, the women are the caregivers, they are sleeping in the hospitals every day. Women are bearing all this brunt.
So what do you hope to achieve from today's protest?
We want our money back, we want our resources that have been plundered to be brought back to the Zambian people so that they can be put, you know, to the proper use. We are also saying that we want those that are responsible, not just the former president who presided, you know, over government, but all others that were involved to also be brought to book. And we want our laws, you know, to be seen to work and for the law to take its course.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I wanted to find out, what are you doing here today?
We are here with our placards and picketing, because really we feel very, very angry that we, the Zambian people, particularly as women and our children, we are the ones that are suffering most as a result of the high poverty levels in the country. So we are very angry that we could have been taken for a ride for the last 10 years. So we are here seeing to it that justice is done, and we are demanding that all the resources that have been plundered are returned back. Some of the houses that we know about should be taken over by the state. We are particularly interested with the FTJ Chiluba Institute. And as a women's movement, we are demanding that that institute could be turned into a women's leadership institute. Zambia has moved from one of the richest countries in the continent. You remember the time of independence. The Zambian kwacha was 1-to-1 with the pound. And now Zambia is one of the least developed countries of the world. That is the way it is categorized, meaning one of the poorest countries in the whole world. And you know, the women and children are the most hardest hit as a result of the high poverty levels. So this is why we are very, very angry, because the money that has been plundered could have been used to deal with issues of safe motherhood, could have been used to educate our children, could have been used to ensure that our hospitals are well equipped, could have been used to create employment for our Zambian people. Most of our children that are leaving school, they have no jobs, they're on the streets. And hence the concept of street kids. Although we are refusing that we have any street kids, we call them our children.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Women protesters in the street of Lusaka, Zambia, singing "Arrest the Thieves" and "We Need Schools, We Need Hospitals." 2 days after this demonstration, Zambia's parliament stripped former President Chiluba of his presidential immunity. After some hesitation, the High Court affirmed Parliament's act August 30th, and police raided Chiluba's house next day, seizing 2 unlicensed guns. The public say more than punishment for Chiluba, they want back the money, including $90 million given the president's daughter Helen, $1.1 million given the president's tailor, and $168 million given to the Chief Justice of the High Court. Thank you, Susan Musukuma in Lusaka, Zambia, for that Wing's special report. Interviewed were Constance Lawanika, Executive Director of Women and Law in Development in Southern Africa, and Grace Kanyanga, Executive Director of the Non-Governmental Coordinating Committee.
Some groups have chosen all to go through the larger gate. Some have chosen to go through the squeeze. So.
Is it okay if we split?
Some yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. Okay. You can use your own conscience whichever way you would like to go.
On Sunday, November 17th, over 10,000 people gathered outside of the gates of Fort Benning, Georgia, home to the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, formerly known as the School of the Americas, an institution long criticized for training Latin American dictators, torturers, and death squad leaders. This year, over 95 people were arrested in acts of civil disobedience, namely for entering the military installation, also known as crossing the line. 5 nuns led the way and were followed by many others, including Daryl Lynn Tom, a schoolteacher from California, and Laura, a veteran and a peace activist.
Why are you going to cross the line?
I am. It's important right now. I think everybody in America should know what's going on right now. And especially because I'm doing this because there's a lot of people that we're not listening to, especially down in Latin America.
My name is Laura, and I'm just thinking that military solutions only end up killing brothers and sisters of mine. So whatever I can do to stop, make us think about different solutions besides military solutions, I'm going to do.
Maria Hone, a Regis University student from Denver, Colorado.
You're friends with the people that just crossed the line?
Yes, that's correct. They go to school with me. 4 people decided to cross the line.
Did they decide to cross the line long ago, or was it just today?
We had discussed this prior to coming down, who in our affinity group wanted to cross the line, and they had displayed interest in doing this, and then they made the final decision this morning that they wanted to join with the mass action and cross the line.
And as students, was the potential loss of financial aid a factor in deciding who was going to cross the line?
Yes, I think it was a deterrent for a lot of people who couldn't afford to risk it. Not getting an education would not be necessarily a great idea in working towards peace either.
If you could give them a message right now, if they could hear you right now, what would you tell them?
I would tell them I'm very proud, and I think what they did was incredible and awesome. And just that we're all proud of them.
Merle Noldy. I'm a Benedictine sister from St. Joseph, Minnesota. I think this action provides the occasion for a good deal of information being shared in local communities from the cities and towns from which these people come. I think that's one of the major issues. My sense is that many U.S. citizens haven't the slightest awareness of the existence of this school and its involvement in situations and policies that they probably couldn't believe are true. I think a lot of people in this country now are more aware of this issue because of the 10 years of witnessing that's gone on here.
This is Shannon Young, outside of the gates of Fort Benning, Georgia, reporting for Wings.
This summer, the village of Tehumoco waged a 3.5-month sit-in at the municipal palace in Oaxaca City, the capital of Oaxaca, a state in southern Mexico. The sit-in was to demand the release of 17 of their villagers, who were arrested by the state attorney general's office. The people of Tehumoco claim they were framed.
On June 1st, military rolled into Tehumoco and arrested 17 people, which were four teenagers and an elderly woman with a terminal disease who's 69 years old, a couple other very older men, all dragged from their homes. Other homes were ransacked. They stole money, basically just terrorized the people. And they all had alibis. There was a work day, a community work day going on that all were present at. Yet they were arrested and they've been detained and they're still detained. The sit-in was to release these people.
International human rights observers Kim Kern and Taryn Tomasella describe the sit-in and their experience there.
50 people from Tehumoco come at a time and stay for about a week or 2 weeks, and then they would leave, and then more people would come in their place. And they would bring food and bananas and feed all the people there. And so there was about 60 to 70 people there at all times. The municipal palace had writing all over it, criticizing the governor, Murat, for having the military come in and arrest these people. And people were sitting there, sleeping there. There was tons of signs with information in Spanish, English, French, so people could see what was happening. They were going to live there until they were released. From the sit-in, two of the teenagers had been released.
It was really, really amazing. They had tapped into the sewer lines and brought in their own porta-potties that flushed. They had tarps set up with fire that was kept going 24 hours a day where women would cook food and prepare food. And there were straw mats set up. Children were playing. Because you have to pay for your stay in Mexican jail, a lot of the prisoners had been making baskets and making crafts. So their families would sit out and sell the crafts to pay for their stay in jail. The people were incredibly strong.
Oaxaca is one of Mexico's poorest states and has one of the worst records of human rights violations in Mexico. This summer, Amnesty International issued a special denunciation about the persistent abuses, including torture and forced disappearances. They noted that the State Attorney General's office had the most violations of any entity in the state.
We were looking to prevent the police from brutally attacking the people. Before we had arrived, there had been attacks against the women and the children. Tear gas, rubber bullets, police coming up and harassing, soldiers coming up and harassing, people in plain clothes who are very obviously affiliated with the government and the military coming up and harassing the people.
Human rights observers play an important role in averting abuses perpetrated by governmental armed forces and paramilitary organizations. With the ability to draw international attention, this presence saves lives. To remove this presence, the Mexican government has used a clause in the Mexican Constitution that prohibits foreigners from engaging in political activity.
It was me and four other U.S. citizens. I was sleeping at the protest with my camera in hand, as we all were, because we knew that we were the protection of the people. We weren't marching with them or anything. We were just observing and documenting the situation, what was going on. And we were playing with some kids outside the palace where the protest was going on, and out of nowhere, about 15 immigration cops showed up and then pushed us into a van.
When we were pushed in the van, one woman was 90 years old in bare feet, ran over and grabbed hold of us and tried to pull us back. And they were completely in danger of being beaten by the police and beaten by the immigration officers, but they were so strong-spirited and were so proud of the fact that we were there that they ran over and tried to surround us and actually kept one of the women who was there observing from being taken away.
We were taken to the immigration office, put in a cell, interrogated for 14 hours, thought we were going to get deported.
And then they said, you will be detained for up to 30 years if you don't leave the country within 3 days.
The fact that we slept there is what made it illegal, and us actually involved in the protest. So that was the reason that they gave us.
2 days after the five foreign observers were taken from the municipal palace, the sit-in ended, although 15 of the villagers remain in jail. The villagers of Tehumoco were arrested for a massacre that occurred on May 31st, 2002. 26 indigenous men and boys from the neighboring village of Santiago Xochiltepec were executed in a military style with high-powered rifles as they were in a truck returning home from work. The State Attorney General's office cites land disputes between the villages as the motivation for the massacre. The people of Tehumoko and human rights organizations point out that those arrested have alibis and that the land dispute was solved 3 months prior in favor of Tehumoko.
There's a lot of theory on who actually committed the massacre. It might be paramilitaries, could be caciques, which are rich landowners that just want the people in Tehumoko out so they can take over the land and sell it to the government so they can extract whatever they want to extract out of the land.
24 people were murdered brutally in a military style. Speculations are that it was government-funded paramilitary people who were retired military officers or retired police officers because they need the land for development under Plan Puebla Panama.
Plan Puebla Panama has been billed as the Latin American megaproject. Multinational corporations and the Mexican government have teamed up to turn southern Mexico and Central America into a free trade and natural resource extraction zone. Critics of the plan say that it will be extremely environmentally damaging, displace many, destroy indigenous culture, and increase the gap between rich and poor. Oaxaca is part of the land slated for development under this project. This is Stacey Pettigrew reporting for Wings.
In an article that appeared in USA Today about elective cesareans, an obstetrician, Dr. Green, he's from Massachusetts, was quoted saying that for a busy woman, it's sloppy and inconvenient to have an unplanned labor. And Green also said that the evidence showing that C-sections are more dangerous for women and babies might not apply to surgeries that can be penciled in on a woman's day planner weeks in advance.
Maureen Murphy from BirthNet tells Wings about the narrowing of options for vaginal birth after cesareans, or VBAC, in hospitals across the U.S.
Many women who have had a previous cesarean plan on giving birth vaginally for their subsequent pregnancies. However, their choice for a VBAC is being denied in many hospitals across the nation. The decision hospitals have made to withdraw support for VBAC is a direct response to current guidelines drafted by the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, or ACOG. In 1999, ACOG published VBAC guidelines, and these guidelines recommended that a physician capable of performing an emergency cesarean be immediately available. Recommendations also include availability of anesthesia and additional personnel. And prior to 1999, the guidelines actually recommended that a physician capable of performing an emergency C-section be readily available as opposed to immediately. In 2000, the American Society of Anesthesiologists, and in 2001, the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations revised their standards to include the same thing. Now, the phrase immediately available is meant to be defined at the local level by each individual hospital. In the last year, hospitals all over the country have changed their guidelines. Some hospitals, and they're mainly community hospitals, maybe in rural areas, kind of smaller hospitals, have said, well, we don't have anybody in the building, we can't afford to have somebody in the building, and so we are just not going to give that option to women. The concern is, with vaginal birth after cesarean section, there is a possibility of uterine rupture, where the previous scar from the cesarean actually opens. However, it's a 1% chance. Now, any laboring woman faces unpredictable complications that may require an emergency cesarean. And the risk is estimated to be 30 times higher than the risk of a uterine rupture with one prior uterine scar. So the argument that women are making is, if hospitals are not set up to deal with the 1% chance of VBAC women coming in and having a uterine rupture, how are they going to deal with other complications? Women are asking, why are you taking this option away from me when something else could completely happen, and then what do we do? Honestly, they are set up to deal with emergencies. What happens is, knowing that there's a risk ahead of time, they are saying, well, we don't want to take this liability issue. But there are so many other liabilities that could happen, so many other complications that they're not talking about. So what it seems like is that cesareans are being pushed on women. Several different articles have come out saying vaginal birth is dangerous, why don't you just opt for a cesarean birth? In New York Times, LA Times, Wall Street Journal, and smaller newspapers in big cities have been coming out with different articles about cesareans and elective cesareans, meaning a woman decides to have a cesarean section before she even tries to labor or have a vaginal birth. She schedules a cesarean birth. So they're promoting C-sections because it's more convenient. And the cesarean section rate has skyrocketed. One out of every four women are now having cesareans. Vaginal birth is not dangerous. Cesarean birth is major abdominal surgery, and it carries with it increased dangers to mothers, babies, and subsequent pregnancies. Research indicates that the rates of maternal mortality and morbidity are much higher with cesarean birth than with any vaginal birth, including VBAC. The trauma and danger of major surgery is really risky, with implications for not just the mothers, but the babies, the families, and society as a whole. Hospitals are putting women and babies at risk for the sake of money, convenience, and their own legal protection. This loss of opportunity to even try to give birth under their own power may not only leave a shadow over their pregnancies, births, and early mothering, but it can also affect their decisions or even ability to become pregnant in the future. So I would encourage women who are opting for a VBAC to find a midwifery practice in their area, because midwifery care, with its emphasis on support and education both prenatally and during birth, have been shown to reduce not only the surgical birth rate, but also the confusion and anxiety about birth that can make women vulnerable to the notion that surgical birth is a safe and convenient option.
That was Maureen Murphy describing how women's options for VBAC, or vaginal birth after cesarean, are disappearing in the U.S. For more information, you can contact BirthNet at birthnetalbany@yahoo.com or 518-482-2504. You can also get more information from the International Cesarean Awareness Network at www.ican.org. This is Stacey Pettigrew reporting for WINGS.
In closing, WINGS pays tribute to Kay Gardner, a feminist lyrical musician who pioneered in the field of healing through sound and taught and published on this subject. Kay Gardner's first album, Moon Circles, debuted in 1975. She was also one of the founders of the lesbian band Lavender Jane and recorded women's classical music as conductor of the New England Women's Symphony. In the 1980s, Gardner sued the Symphony of Bangor, Maine for sex discrimination in hiring its conductor. Gardner was an ordained priestess of the Temple of Isis and was music director of a Unitarian Universalist church, but is known for saying, "Music is my religion." Toward the end of her life, she worked closely with a women's sacred music circle, Women with Wings. Throughout her career, she performed, lectured, and taught on four continents. Kay Gardner passed away on August 28, 2002. This music is from her healing work, Viriditas, on Garden of Ecstasy. Gardner plays the flute. You've been listening to Women's News from WINGS. For more about WINGS, check our website, www.wings.org, or email wings@wings.org. WINGS thanks our station subscribers and our supporters, including Isabel Samfield and Herb Posner, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange. Thanks also to all the friends who helped us move our main studio to Canada. Tax-deductible gifts to WINGS may be made to NRPA/WINGS and mailed to P.O. Box 33220. Austin, Texas, 78764, USA. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.